It's The Takeaway for Monday, June 8th. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Tanzina Vega. Today, we're giving you some time to vent. Are you angry?
Angry doesn't begin to cover the range of emotions I'm feeling. Frustration is probably the main one.
I'm angry because I'm tired of being scared and I don't know what to do anymore.
I'm angry. I think that all the outrage is going to end.
I'm at a loss for words at the inhumanity of George Floyd's murder and the actions taken by police departments for how they're handling peaceful protest.
Is this a rhetorical question? Of course. I am angry, frustrated, numb, sad.
Also on the show, you've heard the calls to defund the police. So what does that mean?
We're really talking about reinvesting that money into services that are better equipped to respond to society's problems.
But first, over the weekend, uprisings against police brutality and racism continued throughout the country. Tens of thousands of demonstrators turned out to demand justice for George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and the myriad black people who have been killed in the U.S. And there are now some signs of change. The Minneapolis City Council says they plan to vote to dismantle their police department in favor of a new system. And here in New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio announced he'd be shifting funds away from the NYPD to other social services. Lots of places are seeing immediate change like this. But the protests also stretched far beyond American borders. Thousands of people turned out in cities, including London, Berlin, Sydney, Tokyo, Many foreign leaders have also condemned the killing of George Floyd, including British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who himself has a history of racist rhetoric.
We mourn George Floyd, and I was appalled and sickened to see what happened to him. And my message to President Trump, to everybody in the United States from the UK, is that I don't think racism or racism, it's an opinion I'm sure is shared by the overwhelming majority of people around the world. Racism, racist violence has no place in our society.
But demonstrators outside of the U.S. are also attempting to turn the lens inward and call attention to racial injustice within their own borders. And whether officials abroad are actually listening to those messages or just pointing fingers at the U.S., that's where we're going to start today. Joining me now is Robin Wright, a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and a columnist at The New Yorker. Thanks for coming back on The Takeaway, Robin.
Always good to be with you.
And also with us is Yasmin Abdelmajid, a writer and broadcaster based in London. Welcome to the show, Yasmin.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt.
So, Yasmin, you're in London. What did demonstrations there look like over the weekend?
So demonstrations here in London started even on Wednesday, and they've sort of been building various cities around the UK, kind of culminating over the weekend. And I, as my voice is testament to, was at some of the protests on the weekend. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, there was a sense of hopeful change and a sense that perhaps this is a moment unlike other moments we've seen before. They were quite peaceful. And I know that there was some reporting of violence and so on, especially in London. But by and large, it was incredibly peaceful. It was incredibly focused. It was partly to do with what was going on in the US. And, you know, we spoke the names of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others, but also, as you mentioned, focused on what happens here in the UK and the systemic discrimination and the police brutality that exists here in the UK. And so there's this real push for people to not only just look at what's going on across the ocean, but to focus within. And that's been pretty incredible to see.
So what kind of issues in the UK? Yasmin, you spoke of your hoarse voice. What sort of chants were you chanting? Were you saying George Floyd's name and Black Lives Matter, but also some more specific messages aimed at issues in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, it started from George Floyd and Black Lives Matter and no justice, no peace, no racist police, to speaking the names of folks who have lost lives to police brutality here in the UK, whether that's Mark Duggan or Sean Rigg or Shegu Bayo. And also, it's not as big a movement yet, but it's definitely something that started to take shape in the UK. The concept of defunding the police, the concept of prison abolition, these are concepts that even a couple of weeks ago, to be fairly honest, as someone who's been in this space for a long time, they have been more kind of radical thoughts, but they have been brought into the mainstream. And also being the United Kingdom, there was talk around what does it mean for us to be in this post-colonial place. I mean, you may have seen reports of the statue of Edward Colston, who was a massive slave trader, who has a statue in Bristol, and the statue was taken down and thrown into the river. And so following on from the sort of in the same vein of the Roads Must Fall campaign that raised its head a few years ago, that's now become a part of this movement as well. And yes, that shifts slightly from the police brutality focus, but it is also about the UK and Britain grappling with and recognizing, hopefully, some of its history and the fact that the racism that exists, you know, in the US found its home almost, or its grandparent, if you will, is the UK, is Britain, because that's where the concept of race was initially formalized. And so it is definitely it's taking shape in lots of different ways.
Robin, you noted in an article last week that many of the signs being carried by protesters abroad are actually in English, even in countries where English is not the main language. Why do you think that messaging is significant?
When the first protests began overseas, it was clear that the focus was on the United States. And it was standing up not just to the issue of racism, but to the issue of domination by the United States in terms of whether it's moral rights or military might. And it was a pushback that reflected a lot of things that have happened over the last 20 years in terms of where America has exerted its influence throughout the region, trying to create the American model, whether it's in Iraq or Afghanistan and elsewhere. But there were also the symbols and the fact that in Britain or in Germany, where the first soccer league opened in Europe, that at one of the big matches, the two players who scored took a knee. And this is a symbol that Colin Kaepernick, who is a 49ers quarterback who made the knee famous, that these are American symbols and that America has defined this issue, but it has also defined the symbols. And so this is the world saying back to the United States, you know, don't preach to us. Do what you say you want us to do. But I also think it does play out and it has grown over the last week so that it does reflect messages to their own governments. And this is what's so striking, that on six continents, you now have movements where people are challenging the legacies of the 20th century. This is a 21st century movement taking on the themes of the 21st, whether it's the end of colonialism and making countries independent, but still subservient to kind of the white world, and playing out on immigration issues, that this issue over George Floyd has deepened as it has grown and takes on what is now very 21st century issues.
It's interesting, Raman. Officials from countries that are U.S. allies and then also leaders from countries that are on far less friendly terms with the U.S. have roundly condemned the killing of George Floyd. Is that unusual? Do foreign leaders normally speak out on specific cases like this? Or do you think they're perhaps taking what they're hearing from the protests in their own countries and turning that around with public condemnations against the United States and United States policy?
There's no question that leaders throughout the world feel the pressure of these movements, and there is a message to them as well. I think the thing that struck me the most was that the European Union, which is a group of almost 30 countries that we have helped form to prevent war in Europe, again, came out with a statement that normally is reserved for dictators. It said it looked forward to all the resolution of all issues with full respect for the rule of law and human rights. And so that was a kind of message that resonated among their own constituents, but I think reflected this, you know, shaming of the United States and particularly of President Trump over the way this issue has exploded across American cities.
Yasmin, you live in the UK, you grew up in Australia, both places had major protests this weekend. What is policing in Black communities and in the UK look like, and then Indigenous communities in Australia look like?
Yeah, so I'll start with Australia. And I think the for context, the Australian Indigenous population or communities also refer to themselves as Black. And so when we talk about policing Black communities in Australia, quite a lot of that is also the relationship between Australian sort of broadly white police, settler police, and the First Nations populations. And I mean, it's so comparable to the United States. There are police deaths in custody. I think there's been over 400 deaths in custody since 91. And interestingly, more police have been promoted after a death in custody than have actually been charged or convicted for any sort of crime. Wow. And the incarceration rates, I mean, I think it's about, in Northern Territory, for example, which is one of the states of Australia, I think population of young people in detention are Indigenous. And there's only about 3.3% of the Australian population is Indigenous, and 28% of the population of those who are incarcerated are Indigenous. And even when there were protests this weekend, hundreds of thousands of people across Australia came out, there was a death in custody during the same time that the protests were going on. And so it's been something that Indigenous communities and Aboriginal communities have been speaking about for decades. The other context I'll give is that the way that Australia was founded was that when the British came, they declared Australia terra nullius, which essentially means they did not have to sign any treaties with the Indigenous population because they deemed the country uninhabited. And any Indigenous people, they tried to kill all the Indigenous people, but any left, they were then wards of the state. And so similarly with the United States, we have a very brutal history between the Black communities and the police. Similarly in Australia, you have that with the Indigenous people and the police. The UK, the history of the police is different, but definitely analogous. And the other thing that I always point out with the Brits is they offshored the worst of their racist brutality. That was what the empire was about. And so often people are like, oh, you know, we don't have the kind of racism here. We don't have the kind of police brutality here in the UK that, you know, you might see in the US or you might see in Australia. But firstly, as I always remind them, it came from the UK, came from Britain. But also when you look at things like Grenfell, which was this building full of social housing that was set on fire, essentially, and almost hundreds of folks died, and it was awful, and it was in one of the wealthiest areas of London. And there's been sort of no change since then. Or if you look at the Windrush generation, so the Brits after the war asked for folks from the Caribbean communities to come to the UK to help them rebuild, and they said, oh, you know, you're British citizens, it's all fine. And then they lost, quote unquote, the citizenship paperwork. And so the way that the Brits do their racism, so to speak, is maybe not as blatant, but it's exceptionally racist. And the way that it's baked into all of the institutions makes it almost more difficult to point to because it's so part of the norm.
Yasmin, you wrote something interesting in Time magazine that you think the pandemic and the fact that much of the world has been locked down for months has somehow given people worldwide the space to focus their attention on this issue in a new way. Am I characterizing that right?
Definitely. I think we cannot divorce this moment from the context in which it appears, which is that we are still in the midst of a global pandemic where millions of us have been forced to stay in our houses in a way that has never happened in our lifetimes. And so it's put a pause on so much, on our social lives, on economic activity, but also it has meant that we have this space to focus on things in ways that we have never had before as a collective. And we are so online, like particularly in English-speaking Western countries, so many of us are working online and socializing online. And therefore, when you see all these conversations around Black Lives Matter and George Floyd's, the video of his murder being circulated, this was not something you could switch off from. There was nowhere for you to go. There was nowhere else to look. And the other thing I think is really interesting is that people had the experience of being at the mercy of a system for the first time. A lot of people, the idea of systemic racism or structural racism is nebulous. It's not super easy to understand, right? But if all of a sudden you're forced to do stuff or you're treated in a way that is not about you as an individual, but is about you as part of a collective, and actually the system is not serving you, it's failing you. Here in the UK, we've had over 50,000 deaths because of coronavirus. And that's effectively because of the failure of governance. In the US, similarly, there's been failure of governance, and people are saying, hey, this system is supposed to protect me. Is this what it feels like to be failed by a system? And then that gives people a bit of a framework to think, oh, maybe their systems are failing other people. Maybe this is what it means when people talk about different systems. There's possibility now to talk about things in a way that didn't exist before. And if I can also add one more thing, we are in an era of the rise of the right wing in a way that I haven't seen in my lifetime, right? The rhetoric that's come from not only leaders in the United States, but in the UK and Australia and so on, is unprecedented, really, for the last, 20, 30 years. And so you've got folks who have felt like they're slipping backwards, have felt like rights are being slowly taken away. And this is a moment where all of that sort of repressed frustration and disillusionment and disempowerment, I think, has coalesced into something much more powerful.
So something revolutionary, perhaps. We've seen symbols of slavery and colonialism targeted in these protests around the world. Statues of Belgium's King Leopold II, who left a murderous legacy in Congo, were vandalized throughout Belgium. The statue of a 17th century slave trader in Bristol, England, which we mentioned earlier, was tossed into the sea. Robin, you've covered a number of protest movements around the world through the years. What do you see as the historical connections that people are making here between these older symbols and then the outrage of this very current killing of George Floyd?
Well, it is in many ways a protest against the past. And this is, as I said, the reaction to colonialism and the legacy of racism that followed. I was in Soweto in June 1976 when the first Black mass uprising began against apartheid, and was there for as it unfolded for over the next 18 months. And of course, it changed a system. But it took 15 years before Nelson Mandela walked to freedom, and I went back to watch that as well. And for all the hope and the momentum of the moment, the fact is it's going to take a long time to get to a place where there is fundamental change that addresses fully and equitably the kinds of demands that these protesters have, and that's the frustration. And the danger of some kind of instability or the lack of connection in the meantime. We can all hope that this moves us along, but the course of history shows that even with the help of social media, it can take time to get to a place that produces significant and enduring change.
Robin Wright is a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and a columnist at The New Yorker. And Yasmin Abdel-Majid is a writer and broadcaster based in London. But thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As protests continue over the killing of Black people by police, calls to defund police departments are gaining traction. In a historic move, Minneapolis City Council members vowed on Sunday to disband their police force and replace it with a new system of public safety. Activists have been calling for a decrease in the budgets of law enforcement for years, and now it seems as though some government officials are finally listening.
Fundamentally, what defunding means is a shift of power and resources away from punitive and harmful institutions like policing and into community-based supportive services. So really what we're talking about is cutting the astronomical amount of money that our governments spend on law enforcement and giving that money to more helpful services like job training, counseling, and violence prevention programs.
That's Paige Fernandez, the policing policy advisor for the ACLU. Tanzina Vega spoke with Paige and asked her whether she thinks defunding police departments is an attainable and realistic goal.
We're not talking about defunding police, 100% across the board immediately.
We're talking more about strategically reallocating resources and funding and responsibility away from police and to community-based models of safety and support and prevention. We talk a lot about the role that police play in society, but there are 10.3 million arrests made per year, and only 5% of those arrests are for what the FBI classifies as the most serious crimes. Things like rape, murder, and aggravated assault. So, you know, 95% of what police arrest people for, the bulk of their work is focused on petty behaviors that have been unnecessarily criminalized. Things like marijuana possession, unlawful assembly. In Alabama, you can get arrested and put in jail for removing a shopping cart from store premises.
I mean, I think over the past, you know, let's say 5 or 6 years, there's been a lot of focus on community reform and policing. Why not, instead of defunding, reallocate those dollars towards reforming policing?
I think that people have tried to reform, right? We've been talking for years about body cameras, training, but quite frankly, we know that is just not enough. The underlying problem with policing isn't the lack of training or community involvement or good procedures. It's the problem that they play way too big of a role in society and have far too many responsibilities and far too much power. Unfortunately, police in this country are empowered to act as an occupying force in low-income communities and communities of color, particularly Black communities. What everyone's realizing now, which is what many Black activists and advocates have been calling for years, is that reform just simply isn't enough. It is not enough. When you look at the roots of policing and where it comes from, policing is an institution built out of chattel slavery. The first police department, modern police force in this country, was in Charleston, South Carolina, and it was a slave patrol. And so it's really difficult for us to reform an institution that from its inception has been tasked with exerting social control and violence on Black and brown people.
What do you see then as a police system that would both ensure public safety and be a productive use of resources? Because I don't think it's realistic to completely defund any measure of public safety.
So I think that there is a role for police to play, but that is for the most serious crimes. And there are police who agree with this. Police have taken on way too much. There are people who have mental health crises, and police are tasked with responding to people who are in the middle of a mental health crisis, and they, quite frankly, are not trained for that, nor should that responsibility fall on them. Police have been tasked with dealing with the issue of drug use in this country, and that issue should not fall on them. So when we're thinking about defunding the police, I really want to emphasize that we're really talking about reinvesting that money into services that are better equipped to respond to society's problems. So thinking about things like violence prevention programs and putting counselors in schools instead of cops, things like job training.
I mean, I do know an NYPD officer here in New York who expressed exactly what you were suggesting, that he doesn't feel equipped to handle, you know, people who are dealing with mental health issues and felt really helpless in terms of engaging with that community. So I think what you're saying, and maybe I'm understanding this correctly, is to really decriminalize areas that, particularly in areas of public health, so mental health, substance abuse, and things like that, so that police can focus on actual criminality.
Well, I think there's two things here. I think the first thing is defunding and reinvesting those resources into what we're talking about, things like mobile crisis patrols, job training, counseling. But I also think we're talking about exactly what you just touched on, is that we really need to prohibit police from enforcing a range of non-serious offenses. And by reallocating those resources, we can do that. By limiting the role and scope of police, we are able to do that. You know, crime isn't random. Most of the time it happens when somebody can't meet their basic needs, and so they go through alternative means. You know, instead of focusing on what I would say is the back end, where police come in once behavior that's been criminalized or an action that's been criminalized has been committed, they come in at that point. But what we're talking about when we talk about defunding and reinvesting is really focusing on the front end. What do we do so that people don't have to engage in the behaviors that would lead them to contact with the criminal legal system?
How realistic is this right now? Do you see support for this, at least among legislators?
I think it is the most realistic it's ever been. I think this is a pivotal moment in the policing movement. And I am so glad that defunding, divestment, and reinvestment has been raised to the national level and that national media outlets are now paying attention to it. And I do firmly believe that there are local and state and federal officials who are listening to these calls for defunding and reinvesting that money. You know, we have local city council members in New York City who are talking about divestment. We have local city council members in Philadelphia who are talking about divestment. The mayor in Los Angeles has said that he is going to cut the LAPD's budget by $100 to $150 million and reinvest that into community-based services. So I really do think we have a moment here to implement real impactful change.
Paige Fernandez is the policing policy advisor for the ACLU. Thanks for being with us, Paige.
Thank you so much for having me.
We turn now to Sam Levin, the LA correspondent for The Guardian, who has been reporting on these efforts in LA and beyond. He told Tanzina that this movement may be gaining traction.
I've been talking to activists across the country, and I think all of them are saying that they're seeing interest from legislators in defunding the police in a way that they've never seen before. And in LA, where I'm based, the mayor here has proposed cutting $100 to $150 million from the budget, which is hugely significant in that he had not previously even entertained the idea of cuts. And in fact, 2 days prior had, you know, finalized a budget that actually included a substantial increase for the police. So in terms of there being momentum around defunding police, we're certainly seeing a sea change here.
Do you think that the renewed interest in making this happen is something that you're seeing that's different? Perhaps what we're seeing in terms of the protests is that they're quite diverse, that there's a diversity of age, diversity of races. Are we seeing this idea of defunding the police really gaining traction among a larger constituency?
It certainly seems that way. There's definitely massive protests happening in these cities that are simply just larger than the kinds of protests we've seen. So they're not just these activist groups out there. There's actually just a massive movement. And I think you're also seeing a lot of protests in smaller cities, you know, in all sorts of communities. People are talking about the victims of police violence who rarely get any national attention. And this is the moment when they're paying attention to that. So I think lawmakers are seeing that they have to respond to this in a way that's different than they previously have. That doesn't mean just talking about reforms and talking about body cameras and training. And it does mean thinking more big picture, big idea about how we respond to this moment.
Can you give us a sense of how police budgets are changing or have changed since you've been covering this?
Yeah, I mean, police budgets have always increased and expanded and are generally not under the table and not questioned in terms of their size. So during the coronavirus economic crisis, a lot of these groups have been, you know, using this moment to say, what are our priorities, right? So cities like LA are having major budget shortfalls, expecting $1 billion drop in revenues and having tens of thousands of city workers facing furloughs, cuts to street repairs, infrastructure, and all of that. But even in the midst of that, you know, the LAPD's budget wasn't questioned until really this week when we saw the George Floyd protests. And so you're seeing that in cities across the country.
Sam, what are the limits of defunding the police? I mean, how far are folks, do you think, really willing to go here?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the next weeks and months play out. There are certainly activists who are pushing for much, much more substantial increases than what we're seeing in LA, for example. The announcement from the mayor is basically reducing the police budget from 53% of the unrestricted fund to 51% of the unrestricted fund. So it is significant in that it's never happened before, but it's not significant in the larger scope of how much we spend on police. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of questions about how this works. But I do think, you know, activists kind of see this as a starting point to making substantial change. And they're hoping that this is just a kind of first step in reinvestment.
Sam Levin is the LA correspondent for The Guardian. Sam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
With everything going on in our nation right now, people taking to the streets to protest the deep racism in this country, and on behalf of the thousands of black men and women who have died at the hands of police, and politicians calling for military action against protesters, people are angry, people are hurting, some are exhausted. Some are finding themselves enraged over systemic racism in this country for the very first time. We asked you if you are angry in this moment and why.
Hi, this is Lori from Philadelphia. The latest publicized incidents of violence against black men has made me confront and feel the anger I suppress daily when seeing how my beautiful, handsome, intelligent, loving son has been treated by police and how it has permanently formed his view of law enforcement and the world. I also feel anger towards those who don't even want to try and understand. I want to shake them and say, look, this is how it is. I realize that I have held my pain when these things happen and have only shared it with close friends and family lest I be considered an angry black woman. But things only change when we speak up.
My name is Jasmine. I'm from Mesquite, Texas, and I'm angry. I think that all the outrage is going to end. I'm upset that the death of Breonna Taylor didn't spark this much outrage because black women need justice too.
Hi, my name is Kimberly, and I'm calling from Olympia. My anger really comes from my inability to explain to my 9-year-old why a man was held down in public and killed simply because of the color of his skin. My son kept asking me, okay, but what did he do that makes it so bad? Why did that happen? How do you explain senselessness and ignorance to children? And how do we stop this cycle?
This is Michael Wood from Lawton, Oklahoma. I've been quite measured in expressing my thoughts, but as a retired Army officer, I'm aghast how the National Guard troops are being used by the states and what is being proposed for active duty forces. No soldier is expected to follow an unlawful order. On the civilian issues, you just don't treat people this way. Watching the clearing of Lafayette Square on Monday this week, law enforcement seems to have no throttle. An unguided missile lit at the hint of the smallest spark.
My name is Julia from Fort Townsend, Washington. I'm angry at all the people who are pushing us to return to normal, when normal is really not okay.
This is Haley from Chicago. Angry doesn't begin to cover the range of emotions I'm feeling. Frustration is probably the main one. I deal with it by getting off social media and letting myself get sucked into a forensic files binge. We have to take time to recharge so we can continue to fight for what's right. Black Lives Matter.
Hi, my name is Jesselyn and I'm calling from Los Angeles. I just wanted to share that I am angry and I am sad and I also feel guilty. As a white woman, I knew that there was racism in our country. I was aware of that. I even knew that it was in our city, but I don't think that I really, really knew. And what has been most impactful about this past week is hearing my black friends' stories and now realizing how restrained they have been in our friendship.
Hi, my name is Billy Huber. I'm calling from Omaha, Nebraska. I'm angry, perhaps more frustrated and confused. I feel like I'm taking a crash course in racism, racial justice or injustice, and white fragility, and the professors and guest lecturers keep contradicting themselves.
Matt from Maine.
I've been angry for many years now. I've been scared for even longer. I'm angry because I'm tired of being scared and I don't know what to do anymore. I've been scared since the first time I had a gun pointed at me by a cop because I didn't look like somebody with my name. I've been scared since I was stopped and frisked in New York because of the color of my skin. I've been scared since I was 6 years old and saw a man brutally beaten on TV by LAPD. I've been scared every day of my life and I'm tired of being scared and told to just calm down and relax. Now I'm scared of how angry I am. I'm angry that 65 years after Emmett Till, we lost Ahmaud Arbery, Medgar Evers, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and thousands of other human beings.
Thank you, as always, for trusting us with your thoughts, reflections, and even with your anger. Please keep calling us to tell us what you feel like in this moment. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Last week marked the start of Pride Month, the annual celebration of the LGBTQ community throughout the month of June. Pride has taken on a more somber tone this year as uprisings against police brutality and a global pandemic continue. And for members of the Black LGBTQ community, this moment has been a reminder of the parallels between what we're seeing today and the early days of the rights movement, namely that both are rooted in police violence. For more on this, we're joined by Imara Jones, founder and creator of Translash Media and journalist in residence at WNYC's The Green Space. Imara, thanks for joining us.
Hello, how are you?
Also with us is Earl Folks Jr., the president and CEO of the Center for Black Equity. Earl, thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Imara, let's start with some history. What role did Black and Brown activists play at the start of the LGBTQ rights movement?
Yeah, Black and Brown activists played a pivotal role in LGBTQ rights. We would not have the movement that we have if it were not for Black and Brown, specifically trans and gender nonconforming people, as we would say today. So not only the ones that the names that you hear often, like Marsha P. Johnson, who's a Black trans woman, and Sylvia Rivera, who was Latinx trans woman, but also others like Miss Major, and there are many, many names in that beginning, opening, first couple of nights of Stonewall. But even though Black and Brown trans people started the movement, they were very deliberately pushed out of the movement over the next 4 to 5 years. So they've not been able to benefit, we have not been able to benefit fully from the movement that we created.
And do you see the protests that we're seeing right now is more in line with Pride's real roots than maybe the massive Pride parades that people may associate more with Pride Month, Imara?
Yeah. As I say to people often, Pride, everyone's like, oh, this month Pride is different. And I said, no, Pride is, like you just stated, actually returning to its roots. You know, of course, Stonewall began as a rebellion against police brutality and a police raid against Stonewall, which was known to be a bar that was frequented by Black and Brown queer people, trans and gender nonconforming, and was targeted by the police as an easier target for a raid than predominantly white gay bars. And so the very roots of it are that. And over the first couple of nights, that's why it was a battle between these communities and police because of that. And so, you know, as the saying goes, Stonewall was a riot. We have to remember that. And so Pride now is deemed as a celebration, but it started out as a dramatic pushback against police brutality. But because we know that police misconduct is tied to a larger system that is enforcing a hierarchy, enforcing marginalization, it then grew into a larger call for political and economic rights, which happened the next year after the Stonewall Rebellion. So this is actually the 50th year of the first march. And in that march was a call for these greater rights. But and it was also organized in large part by a group of drag queens and trans women, and then expanded. So those are the roots that we are growing from at this moment.
Earl, do you think the Black LGBTQ community has been erased from the history of that movement, and are we maybe starting to see a shift from that today?
Well, you know, whoever gets it right, the history tells it through their lens, and the fact of the matter is that the participation of Black and Brown individuals in the greater LGBTQ's queer space has been whitewashed by white historians who don't know or didn't do enough research or didn't care or purposely excluded our participation in these movements. We've always been part of every movement, and we've been part of every war, and so to say that what happens is that people get caught up in who threw the first rock. Who was the first person to throw the first rock at Stonewall? And they get caught up with that. And no one asks who fired the first shot at Lexington. No one cares. A shot was fired and it started a revolution. And the fact of the matter is a brick was thrown through the window and a revolution started. And Black and Brown individuals have always been part of the greater queer movement. And we unfortunately have not written our own history, and therefore we suffer the results of that, and that's exclusion.
And Earl, in the same way, the killing of Black transgender people by the police, like Tony McDade in Florida, hasn't gotten the same level of attention as other incidents of police brutality, right?
Well, you know, let's go even deeper than that. The fact of the matter is that when we say Black Lives Matter, it should be all Black Lives Matter. I've heard of incidents from my colleagues from around the country where queer Black folks have been marched and they've been harassed by some of the people who are marching in the parade and who object to their presence in these demonstrations and this rebellion. And the fact of the matter is that we have to deal as Black people, we have to deal with homophobia and transphobia within the Black community, and we have to deal with racism in the greater LGBTQ space.
Earl, you've played a key role in the spread of Black Pride celebrations across the world. Why was it important for you to create space for the Black LGBTQ community?
Well, for precisely what I stated before, those of us who are people of color, particularly Black and Brown folks, we have our feet in two sets of communities. We have our feet in the Black community, which is often hostile to our aspiration of full citizenship and equal rights. And we have then we have to deal with the racism of the white community, which we've talked so much about recently. And the fact is that we need to create a safe space for our community members. And Black Prides, there are about 55 Black queer prides around the world today. Most are in the United States, and we draw about 500,000 people each year. And these people come to our events because they want a safe space. They don't want to have to be one or the other. They can actually celebrate being Black and being queer. And especially for our marginalized parts of our community, such as youth, seniors, transgender men and women, this is very important. We continue to create safe spaces for people to become full citizens and enjoy who they are and be productive. And that's all we want, is to be productive members of our society and have equal rights and equal access to the institutions of our society. And that's what Black Pride helps facilitates.
Earl, I'm curious about the presence of law enforcement at these events. I've seen police at other Pride events. Are they also at these Black Pride celebrations?
Well, you know, interesting. I can't speak for all the prides, but I probably have attended 300 prides of all kinds in the world, around the world. And I can say that in the Washington, D.C., which is where we have the largest Black Pride, which is 75,000 people attend, in Atlanta, which is also has a large Black Pride and a large outdoor presence, police are at a minimum. They're at a minimum. The reality is that we don't need a lot of police force presence. And especially this new type of policing that we've seen since the 9/11, this paramilitary policing, You know, we stand for community policing, where police officers or law enforcement live in the community, are part of the community, and understand the community. And we don't usually need a lot of law enforcement. Our people don't need that. We may have minimal security, but we very rarely have incidents within our spaces that require a lot of police presence or law enforcement. Police are welcome to come. Some do come in and out of uniform, but they understand that this is a community event, and they're coming as community members, not to enforce rules or for crowd control. We can control our own people.
Imara, given the protests against police brutality around the country, have you been thinking about alternative ways to honor or observe Pride right now?
Well, I mean, I think we have to, given the reality of COVID. And I think a lot of the movement has moved online and has gone digital, like in a lot of places. And so I think just because of where we are in the moment, that's happening, and that there is an emphasis on protest and on activism and on supporting local organizations which are doing the work for marginalized communities that don't get a lot of the focus. I think that's really important. But if I could, I wanted to just return to a couple of points that were made earlier by Earl, who is legend in our community for many reasons that you are hearing about this morning. I think it's really important to realize that it's not only that history may or may not have been written by people, it's also because people were deliberately pushed out. In the 1974 march in Washington Square Park, Silvio Rivera was deliberately pushed out by white lesbian and gay organizers who took over the movement. You can actually see that in reality. There is video of her being booed off the stage and banned because of that. And so our exclusion has been deliberate. It's not been by an act of omission. You know, it's been an act of commission. And on this point of what's happening, I think for me, one of the harshest realities that took place last week, actually literally a week ago, is the beating of Ayanna Dior, who is a trans woman, by a mob in a convenience store in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And many of these people are the same people who called for her, who are calling for Black Lives Matter, the end of police brutality, and the end of mistreatment, but then saw her as less than human and set upon her in a way that they are asking that other people not do them. And the fact that was in George Floyd's city is really searing. As I wrote about, actually poses a dilemma for a lot of Black trans women about the degree to which we participate in a lot of the protests that are happening right now. I think that's an individual decision, but it is one that people are wrestling with. So there are complexities here that flow out of the last 50 years.
Earl, taking those complexities, how does this moment and this movement change the way we think about Pride moving forward? Are you looking at it through a more nuanced, more complicated lens? And where do you think it goes from here?
Well, as a member of the overall LGBTQ space, and not just Black Pride, Black DC, for all of our Black Prides, we don't take a lot of commercial dollars. We're under-resourced as is, and those are basically, we use the resources within our community. But looking at the larger Pride events, like in New York and Washington and in the larger cities, where they have become, Amara is correct, they've become commercialized. They become corporate. All the corporate sponsorships, the pride parades now last hours, you know, sometimes up to 10 hours or longer. The New York Pride Parade is much too long, and much too much corporate sponsorship. It should be people in the community. It used to be a time at the beginning of the Pride movement, of the modern day Pride movement, because there's always been people doing things in to advance LGBTQ rights in our movement, in our community. But at the beginning, anyone could march in the parade. You didn't have to register. You didn't have to pay. You just stood and marched. And we need, like people are doing now, and we need to get back to Corporations can support our community in different ways and provide resources in different ways other than spending millions of dollars and putting on a pride parade. Parades should be for people just to walk, and anyone can join in the parade like they used to be. Like the Halloween parade in New York used to be very, very spontaneous, and people would dress up and march. Now you have to register, and that takes away from the whole spirit of it. And who wants to sit through a 10-hour corporate parade?
Shorter and more focused going forward. Earl Folks Jr. is the president and CEO of the Center for Black Equity, and Imara Jones is founder and creator of Translash Media and a journalist in residence at WNYC's The Green Space. Thank you to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
And hey, folks, that's all for us today. Appreciate you talking with us here on The Takeaway, and you can find more from our conversations at thetakeaway.org. I'll be back on Friday hosting Politics with Amy Walter, but until then, follow me on Twitter at MattKatz00, and the show is at The Takeaway. We'll see you tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.